Boys, there's some positively lovely summer days lately, huh?
Yeah, it's beautiful really, out there.
Yeah, I'm used to 90, 92, 94, 95 in the summer in the middle of July. Here we are, and we've had 80s, and at nighttime, middle 60s, low 60s, so that's been very pleasant, but 90 tomorrow. 81 is the expected high today, huh?
Yes, it is.
And the 81. Current temperature, what did you say it is at the airport?
72.
72 degrees. Blue skies.
72.
Oh, man. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. This is John Williams at 9 after 10 here on WGN Radio. I'm here until noon, and you can always hear this show from 1 to 3 Monday through Friday on WGN Radio. There are some great mysteries in the world, right? I mean, the Kennedy assassination, and you could look more recently, you can look way back in time, and people still scratching their head wondering about that. One that I thought we had put to rest was Amelia Earhart, and that is that her plane went down and they ran out of fuel, and that was kind of it. I mean, obviously there have been other theories, and we didn't have the evidence to necessarily prove that. But then, look, lo and behold, there is this History Channel special, which comes up tomorrow night at 8 o'clock here in Chicago. On July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator and co-pilot took off in a heavily loaded Electrica aircraft. Intended destination was Howland Island, a tiny sliver of land, 6,500 feet long and 1,600 feet wide, 10 feet high, and 2,500 miles away. You want to get in an airplane without modern GPS and shoot for a little dot like that? She wanted to be the first woman to circumnavigate the globe. So one of the people that made the film, the producer and president of Morningstar Entertainment, is Gary Tarpinian. He joins us now on WGN Radio. Hi, Gary. It's John Williams. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, John. It's a pleasure. And by the way, I couldn't have done a better description of the show than you just did. So let me know if you're interested in coming out to L.A. at some point and being a TV producer.
Yeah.
You need some good people out here.
We'll do lunch. Do they do lunch? Do you all really do that? Do you do lunches and have the sorts of high-pitched meetings that we think sometimes over, you know, spritzers or whatever?
Well, I would say I think the meetings in L.A. are the same as the ones you have in Chicago and New York in terms of business. The only difference is we don't wear ties.
I understand that there's this photograph which has sort of launched our interest in the search for Amelia Earhart again. Is that really the pivot point of this whole documentary?
Yes, we found a photo that we believe is a smoking gun. There have been many, many theories as to what happened to Amelia Earhart over the years. You mentioned that. There are people who believe in the so-called conventional wisdom historical record as put forth by our own U.S. government, that she simply ran out of fuel, crashed into the sea, and drowned. There are other people that claim she was marooned on a desert island. There have been some very silly theories, including one that says she was Tokyo Rose, and another one that she moved back to New Jersey under an assumed name. So we run the gamut on what happened to her from, you know, the sublime to the ridiculous. The reason we produce this show is at Morningstar, we see no point in telling a story on any topic. Pick it, King Tut, the Kennedy assassination, Waterloo, whatever, unless we find some new information that changes history. And when a researcher by the name of Les Kinney showed us a photo that he found after 10 years of painstaking research in the U.S. National Archives, he really got our attention. This photo is real evidence, which is something none of those other so-called theories as to what happened to Earhart have. And one of them, in fact, is the official U.S. government record by the Navy saying that, you know, she crashed and sank. I would like to point out they never found her plane. They never found her body. They never found an oil slick. So how do you confirm someone died and crashed in the sea if you really don't have the evidence?
Where did the photograph come from, and what does it show?
The photo was found in a dusty, you know, long sort of neglected area of the U.S. National Archives. It was in a collection of photos that had been assembled for military planners. It was the early 1940s. We were already at war in the Pacific against the Japanese, and we were planning to invade the Marshall Islands, which, in fact, the U.S. did do in 1943 and 1944. And in order for the military planners to know where they're going, what they're looking at, I would like to remind your listeners that this is before there was no GPS. There were no spy satellites. There were no U-2 planes flying over taking pictures. The only way in which military planners could have any idea of what they were getting into is they would look at, for instance, old issues of National Geographic on the Marshall Islands. Hmm. If some tourists had gone there and taken photos, they would request those. So what we found was a package of a few hundred photos, all of the Marshall Islands, for these planners. And in there was this very innocent-looking photo that simply said, Jaluit Harbor, Jaluit Island, Marshall Islands. And it was then inserted into this pack of information. However, upon closer examination, as you start looking at the photo, it reveals some incredible things. And what those things are Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Newman.
Why do you say that with such confidence? I mean, it's a black and white photo. They aren't the object of the photo. There's some distance. How do you know it's them?
Mm-hmm. Great question. Here's what we believe. So many of the files or any information on Amelia Earhart is missing. It's simply not there. We believe that at some point, the U.S. government knew that Earhart had been captured and, for reasons explained in our documentary, chose to do nothing about it. Once that decision was made to not rescue her or to abandon her, what began then was a massive cover-up. Now, I'm not one given to all these, you know, wacky conspiracy theories, but every now and then you come across a story such as this one where I do believe that the U.S. government has tried to keep us from knowing her fate all these years.
Why would the Japanese have... I guess this was just before World War II. Were we hostile with Japan at the time? If they have the famous Amelia Earhart, I suppose they could have done a lot of things with that. Propaganda, save her for a prisoner exchange. I mean, there would have been a lot of collateral value there. I don't know why they would bury that asset, right? I mean, how does that wash out?
Well, great question again. One of the things I'd like to make clear to your listeners is we like in these documentaries to say this is what we know. But when we're not sure, we're not afraid to say we're not sure, so let's speculate. What we do know for a fact is this, based on the photo, which the top digital photo analysts in the country have looked at. It's real. It wasn't photoshopped or manipulated. What we know from the photo is this. Amelia Earhart did not crash into the sea. She crash-landed in the Marshall Islands. She was rescued by the Marshallese. She was brought to Jaluit, a deep-water port in the Marshall Islands, and taken away by a Japanese ship, the Koshu. This is what we know. What we're going to have to speculate on is, why didn't they give her up? Why did they take her away? Where did they bring her? How long was she there? How did she die? Did our government know about this? If they did, why didn't they rescue her? And why have they covered up ever since? So, in a sense, John, even though the photo answers some questions, it really raises more questions than answers.
The documentary spends some time demonstrating that the plane had enough fuel to get to her intended target, but she was unable to find it. Maybe they were off course. She did have a plan B, and that was to circle back to the Marshall Islands, and that she would have had enough time and enough fuel to do that. Why didn't she successfully get back to the Marshall Islands then?
Well, this is what we believe happened, and it's really shown in wonderful detail in our show by our aviation expert, Colonel Dan Hampton. Dan is the most decorated F-16 pilot in U.S. history. He's a handsome pilot. It looks like he came from Central Casting. And he also served on many accident investigation boards in the U.S. Air Force. That's the equivalent of the Air Force's NTSB, where they investigate crashes. Actually, the Air Force corrected me. They don't have crashes in the Air Force. They only have mishaps.
Huh.
So I want to make that distinction. But anyway, Colonel Hampton, you know, he's investigating crashes and knows all things flying, the fuel, how many gallons she had, how many miles to the gallon, et cetera, et cetera. He did all the research and was just incredible what he was uncovered. And here's the story. She even told people, friends, and we have this in letters she wrote, that if I can't find Howland Island, then I'm just going to turn back and go straight west over the last island chain I passed, which is the Gilbert Islands. And the Gilberts were under the control of the British at that time. They were a colony. However, she was a couple of hundred miles north of Howland. So when she got to that point where she was low on fuel and she decided to go west back to the Gilberts, unfortunately for her, she flew back into the Marshall Islands, which were under the control of the Japanese and off limits to foreigners and the United States. The Navy says this is the greatest search, you know, in history, thousands of miles, hundreds of planes. Unfortunately, they were looking in the wrong place. She was not anywhere near Howland Island. She crashed into the Marshall Islands.
Gary Tarpinian's on a phone line. He's the president of Morning Star Entertainment, one of the producers of this Amelia Earhart documentary, The Lost Evidence. It premieres tomorrow night on the History Channel at 8 o'clock. One last thing. Who was Amelia Earhart? You know, she was one of the most famous people in the world, we understand, and it was an age where if a woman could fly an airplane around the world, that was a big deal. That was certainly a glass ceiling, I guess, and she was going to crash it. Was she that sort of person? Was she somebody who was always for women's suffrage and rights, or was she just an adventurer? Who was she?
She was one of the greatest Americans and greatest women who have ever lived. When Colonel Dan Hampton first walked up to the Lockheed Electra, we went to an air museum and took a look at it, he shook his head and thought, wow, does she have balls? She was going to fly around the world in this?
Yeah.
Am I allowed to say that word on the radio?
Yes, you may, even in the Midwest.
Okay. She had courage, you know, and she did something incredible. The other thing a lot of young women who work for me have said is that if you think about it, Amelia Earhart, in a way, began the feminist movement. She was not political. She didn't give speeches. But what she showed through example is that a woman could do anything. And in the 1920s and 30s, flying and aviation was the cutting edge of technology. This was the adventure. This was the equivalent of, like, Columbus and people getting in boats and sailing west. She had this spirit of doing that. And not only was she the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic, she was the first person, man or woman, to solo many of the parts of the Pacific. She would have been the first person to circumnavigate the world around the equator. What she was doing was incredible. And when we saw this photo and started learning what we believe is an alternative story and perhaps the truth of what happened to her, we felt we owed it to her and her legacy to set the record straight.
Tomorrow night at 8 o'clock on the History Channel. Hey, Gary, congratulations. Good luck to you guys, and let's visit again. Keep up the good work.
John, thank you so much. My only regret is I'm not, like, sitting at a pizza Uno right now having a great deep dish slice of Chicago pizza.
Cubs are in town, too. It's going to be a good day.
All right, my friend. Thanks so much.
Gary Tarpinian. 10:22. By the way, speaking of baseball, Sam has a few questions he needs to answer to us about the Serbian national baseball team in the area. This is a game I would go see. Maybe you will too. You know, one thing about Amelia Earhart, I just want to go back to that one little statistic. She flies that little plane. I mean, it was big enough to hold a thousand pounds of fuel, or gallons of fuel, but still, you want to get in that thing, you and one other guy. You're going to leave at midnight, dark of night. They're off, let's see, I'm not sure where she took off from. Took off from Lay Field. Was that in New Guinea? Anyway, she takes off. Dark of night, it's midnight. And she's going to fly with the destination of something that is a tiny little island, 6,500 feet long, and 1,600 feet wide. It's just a little sliver. At its highest point, it's 10 feet high. It's just a strip, but you could land there, refuel, and from there take off again. She's going to hopscotch her way around the world this way. She has to fly 2,556 miles to get there. And they're navigating by stars and line of sight and some radio frequencies and stuff like that. Obviously, they made a mistake, and we don't know what happened exactly. But he's right. That takes some BALLS now, doesn't it? You and I fly in very luxurious, sophisticated aircraft, and if we get a little bump, we go, huh. I'll bet she had some turbulence along the way, too. Pitch black, flying along, hoping you're doing it right. And if you don't, you die. I don't know what that is. Courage? Chutzpah? Something. The Serbian national baseball team is in the area. They're playing in Northwest Indiana. Is that where they are? This is some sort of amateur baseball tournament you've been covering over there, Sam?
Yeah, well, the team is in town. They flew in on the 6th, 17 hours from Serbia to Chicago. Then they drove to Indiana. They're playing 5 games in 6 days as they prepare for the World Championships. That'll be in Belgrade later this year.
And what kind of baseball program does Serbia have?
There is one baseball field in the entire country.
And how old are these players?
They are ranging from 16 to 42. It's still building. When you think of Serbia, you think basketball, you think water polo, you think soccer. So baseball is relatively, I don't want to say relatively new, but it's relatively new on the national stage. So they're just trying to build a program here. And they played last night. They're playing at Oil City Stadium. Have you been? It's in Whiting.
I've been to some of those Northwest Indiana ballparks.
Right
I haven't
by
been.
The lake. It's right by the lake. You
oh,
look
really?
Out and you see Lake Michigan.
Nice.
It's beautiful. But no, they're excited. I was told that this is the first trip ever to America for the Serbian baseball team.
You know, it's so sweet, isn't it? The long, arduous trip to America. Here they are in Chicago. I'll bet they love the city or the skyline. They're going to play in nice ballparks, certainly compared to what they're used to in Serbia. And their team is late teens to early 40s, for crying out loud. I don't like their chances, huh?
Well, the coach told me we're somewhere in between high school and college team. So I said, well, it may be an uphill battle against the pro teams. But the thing is, John, they only practice a couple times a month. So they're not getting 60 at-bats a week like these pro baseball teams get because of the logistics and all the travel that they have to put together just to actually play together. They have to go around Serbia picking everybody up and then driving them all to practice. It's not like everybody gets a ride to the field.
That's what my coach used to do. We'd get in the back of the pickup truck when we played for Walt Schlimmer Realty in Edwardsville, Illinois. He'd drive around, but we were in sixth grade. And we were just playing in a little league. So he picks everybody up in the pickup truck, all these happy Serbians bouncing around in the back of the thing you can see there, and then they play. I'm rooting for them. Have they played any games yet at all?
They lost last night 8-2.
Two? That's not bad.
They got two. That's against the Oilmen Ace, I was told. They play again today. They play on Sunday and then on Tuesday and Wednesday night.
Yeah, I'm rooting for the Serbian national baseball team.
You wish they had a name, though.
I know. I think we should give them something. I don't know enough about Serbia to know what would be an appropriate name for them. The Serbs? I don't know. I got to come up with something better
well,
than that.
Well, you said Serbian Tigers earlier.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's that. Don't use Redskins or something like that, though, guys. Just, you know, keep it neutral. We like animals. The Serbian Bears. The Serbian Dogs.
I like alliteration, though. We need an S name.
Right. The Serbians... Snakes. No, that's not good.
That sounds terrible. The Salamanders.
The Serbian Salamanders.
The Fighting Sioux.
No, don't do that.
I know.
The news is next on WGN. 1040, John Williams in the Allstate Showcase Studio, downtown Chicago on Michigan Avenue. Come by, wave, say hi. Yesterday, on Friday, we always do this. About 1:40, we do something called The Bright Side. Pardon me, around 2:40. That's where you call and tell us what the good news is in your world. Our first call yesterday, something that's making you happy, is somebody who said, we have a budget. We have a budget. I'm so proud of our state lawmakers, aren't you, that they were actually able to make a budget. The Mincing Rascals discuss that in our weekly broadcast of the podcast after 11 o'clock. Here on WGN Radio. This just in is a potential name for the Serbian national baseball team, the Slaw Dogs. As in coleslaw and a hot dog, the Slaw Dogs. They deserve better than that, people. Come on, we can come up with something.
Sounds like an insult a little bit.
I know, I don't like that.
The national animal for Serbia is the white eagle.
Nice.
That is nice.
Very well.
Red, white, and blue, and a white eagle.
Who doesn't love that? So maybe forget the alliteration, just the white eagles.
I like the text coming in, though. The Serbian spirit, the Serbian saints, the Serbian sharks, the Serbian violettas.
Violeta Podramatic is there right now, in fact. That's her home country. She's visiting her peeps.
Yeah, she went to go see the team, and they're here.
Speaking of baseball.
Ray, people will come, Ray. They'll come to Iowa, for reasons they can't even fathom. They'll turn up your driveway, not knowing for sure why they're doing it. They'll arrive at your door, as innocent as
if you're
children.
Clicking around your TV and you come up on this, it's against the law to turn it off.
Of course, we won't mind if you look around, you'll say. It's only $20 per person. They'll pass over the money without even thinking about it.
But there's a book out, and it's called Movies Are Prayers.
Just sign the papers.
And it cites a bunch of movies and scenes, and it says these just aren't great stories.
On a perfect afternoon.
These are prayers. There are different kinds of prayers. We pray for all sorts of things with all sorts of motivations for all sorts of reasons, but that movies can be prayers. Before you dismiss that, Josh Larson, who wrote the book, isn't just some Johnny-come-lately. He is a noted film critic. You may have listened to his podcast, Film Spotting. You may have read him in Think Christian. About his latest book, Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune says he makes an inspiring case for treating a provocative variety of films as prayers for all seasons. Brian Tallarico, who comes on this show a lot, gives it great praise. He said that this book is both confident and insightful. And I love that description because I think the book is insightful. It's intriguing. He needs to make his case. He will hear in a second. But it's confident, too. He doesn't backpedal or backtrack. He said, no, here's what I think, and you're either going to come along with him or not. Well, let's come along with him for a couple of minutes. Josh Larson joins us, the author of Movies Are Prayers, How Films Voice Our Deepest Longings. Hey, Josh, it's John Williams. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks so much for having me on the show. It's been a while since I've been on WGN. I used to do, from time to time, appear on Milt Rosenberg's Extension 720. So it's been a while, but it's good to be back on the air with WGN.
Boy, you're the real deal if you were on with Milt.
He was great. Always a challenge and exciting to be on his show, for sure.
Did you talk religion with him or films?
You know, it was mostly a film panel I was a part of, but as you know, you never knew which direction you were going to go with Milt, so those were interesting shows to be a part of.
Eventually, all topics came back to Judaism, World War II, something like that, you know?
Right.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your book. Where do you get off, fella, thinking you can write a book with a premise like this?
Well, it's really approaching movies in the way that everyone does, and by that I mean we all take a specific lens to the films we see, and sometimes we're more aware of those and direct about how we want to go about that. So there are feminist approaches to film theory. Some critics prefer auteurist approaches where they look specifically at the director as author and see how a film lands in the expanse of their career. This is just one other angle of looking at films. It's not the only angle. It's not the answer that all of these movies necessarily were made to do this thing. But it's a possible way to look at film through a lens of faith. And I narrowed that even more here by making the suggestion that one way to see films functioning is that they function in the same way some of the prayers do that we offer.
So is the prayer the part of the filmmaker, or am I praying as I get your point, as I experience movies, we feel a rush of different emotions and they can be profound. I see how they could be prayerful, particularly when you define the kind of prayer. But is it the prayer of the filmmaker or me, the recipient?
I think it's in that mysterious place in between. So I mostly deal with non-religious films in the book. Yeah. And right there, you can see that I'm not saying this is what the particular filmmaker meant to do. But I do argue that once a movie makes its way through so many creative hands, you know, even those that have a strong director behind them, there's often, especially when Hollywood gets involved, hundreds of creative artists who work on this film, that it becomes its own separate thing once it's released into a theater. And then it becomes something different when a particular audience goes to watch that film, again, through the lens that they bring to it. So at that point, I'm arguing the movie can function as a form of prayer that resonates with people in that audience. So say prayers of lament is one type of prayer I talk about. If someone goes into a film and they have much lament in their heart, maybe they've already expressed it through prayer, maybe they're struggling to do that, maybe they're not even a person of faith, but they still feel that weight. If they watch a movie that is full of lament and is also doing something similar, then together there's this alchemy where something akin to a prayer becomes offered. And then as a person of faith, it's my belief that God hears that prayer just as much as he hears the prayer of someone who might offer it in a church.
So as I'm feeling, experience, thinking these thoughts as I'm watching Field of Dreams or Wizard of Oz, and you talk about, you even include Fantastic Voyage. I mean, it's a gamut of films, right? But as I'm doing that, you think that that is akin to prayer.
Yeah, I think it can very well model not just prayer in general, not just, you know, spiritual thoughts, but very specific forms of prayer. Some of those films you mentioned, I argue, cover something like prayers of yearning, prayers of praise, and, you know, prayer of lament, as I just mentioned.
And to the degree that I think prayers are valuable, that I'm actually having a meaningful communication with God, do you think God receives them that way? Or does he go, this isn't a prayer, you're watching Field of Dreams. Who are you kidding?
It is my distinct belief that God hears all of these expressions we offer, whether they're personal, something, again, we do in church or through our daily devotions, or whether it's something communal. And that's what movies become. Again, after so many people have been involved, more people come to watch them. And if they gather around a certain elemental expression of the human experience, people saying, here's what I think of this place I've found myself and my place within it. Of course, God wants to hear that stuff.
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you, I think your writing in your book is so good that you persuaded me, because I came into this as a skeptic. I thought the title is clever, but you cannot pull this off. And and the more I think about my resistance, though, the more I think it's artificial, because I do allow that literature can be prayerful, and I do allow that music, when we're all singing together and you get goosebumps. I think this harmony is more than just music. It's meaningful to me, and maybe it's even spiritual. So why am I so resistant to movies having that same sort of impact on my head, my heart, my soul, you know?
Maybe it's because movies have such a broad range and type, and that not all of them are going to function this way.
Right.
I mean, I'm the first one to admit there's
right.
movies that there's nothing to them, right?
Well, so you're not saying
maybe that's part of it.
You're not saying the movies are all intrinsically prayers or prayerful, but that certain scenes or certain films are, right?
Yeah, I do spend a lot of time very focused on specific moments in these movies. Now, some of them, taken all as a whole, Field of Dreams, I do write about as a prayer of obedience. I think that's very central, this idea of obedience to what Field of Dreams is about. But most often it is moments and scenes in films. And that allowed me to pay real attention to the actual aesthetic choices that the filmmakers were making. Because one danger here would be to hijack these movies and say, this is what I want to make it about. But I've found that if you write about specific details, so choices in production design or cinematography or even costume design, then you are making a stronger case that even if the filmmaker didn't intend for the film to be a prayer like this, the details that they arrived at do work together to offer the possibility that it could work like that.
Oh, I think that's true for authors and musicians as well as filmmakers. You may say it's about that, artists of any stripe, but here's what it's to me, and
sure.
My answer is in some ways more correct than yours.
But,
sure. But now I've got to ask you, okay, so just give me some scenes and give me the sense of them, or maybe tell me what other people have been telling you, because my guess is now that the book is out, people are going, I've had that very same experience. It was this movie, it was this scene, and I felt that emotion. And that's what I want to get to in a minute. Movies Are Prayers is a book by Josh Larson. It's subtitled How Films Voice Our Deepest Longings. We'll pick it up here in a minute on WGN. Sunny puffs of white skies downtown Chicago. This is John Williams. We're on Michigan Avenue in the Allstate Showcase Studio. 11 o'clock, the news. Afterwards, the Mincing Rascals podcast, the broadcast of the podcast where we talk about state politics. Chris Christie gets a mention. We'll let the gang wax a little bit about that. Excuse me. And then after that, we'll go finally back to the list of recommendations for the Serbian national baseball team. Strangely, that lit up the phones here. But we'll finish this conversation first with the charming and delightful Josh Larson, the film critic whose reviews of movies you may listen to on Film Spotting. He writes for Think Christian. He's a critic there. And his latest book is Movies Are Prayers. Movies Are Prayers. So, Josh, just talk to me about a couple of films specifically. Like, we did Field of Dreams. You do Fight Club in the movie. How in the world do you derive prayerful value out of Fight Club?
Well, the first thing I had to do is make the case that one form of prayer we offer would be prayers of anger. And I start out in that chapter wondering if we should. You know, this is not necessarily how we're called to communicate with God, but we find that we're going to express that anger no matter what. It's just part of our fallibility, and perhaps expressing it as prayer is better than shoving it deep down or, you know, exerting it on other people. And Fight Club to me is very much an exercise in anger, just spewing this bile about, you know, the consumerist society that the main character has not only found himself in, but has also broken him to some degree. And so, yeah, that's a prayer of anger to me, right alongside Rebel Without a Cause with James Dean. I include both of those next to each other. So there are a variety of movies, and this is how I watch movies, from all periods, all different genres. So I wanted to be as inclusive as I could when I wrote about films as prayer in the book. So I go from all the way from, you know, Fight Club and Rebel Without a Cause to Toy Story. And that was one of the most interesting to write about as a prayer of confession. I'm talking about the first Toy Story here. And we see that story is all about Buzz Lightyear coming to the confession that he's not this perfect space ranger that he thinks he is, that he wants to be, but he's actually just a toy. And again, part of the exploration I do at the beginning of the chapter is, what is a prayer of confession? It's not just saying, here are the bad things I did. You know, in the Christian tradition, it is this acknowledgement that we are not the people we purport to be, and we're not capable of being perfect people. And so to pretend that is itself kind of a basic point of pride. And Buzz Lightyear learns that throughout the film. There's a beautiful, this goes back to what I was talking about in terms of paying attention to the detail, beautifully animated moment where Buzz Lightyear is seeing a TV commercial of the Buzz Lightyear toy. So it's right in his face that he is actually a toy. And the Pixar animators allow us to see the reflection
right.
of the TV Buzz Lightyear in his glass helmet. And so you have the two Buzzes there, kind of the fake Buzz and the real Buzz, looking at each other in this amazing moment of confession.
Yeah, you're right about that. And I played the scene back in my head. Then you describe how he dives off to fly and breaks his arm. And it's such a sweet and sad scene. And so that's his realization that he's not this thing. He's more a toy, right? Or does he come to that realization then?
Yeah, that's you know, sort of the argument, the connection I'm making to confession is the first thing we have to do is be honest with ourselves and with God who we are. And that's what Buzz is doing in that scene, you know? And it does lead soon into that climax where when he tries to fly in denial that he's a toy, he crashes, right? But once he's accepted that, we get the finale of Toy Story with the help of others. He goes off in that rocket and then is dropped and kind of glides back into Andy's car. A little bit different than the, you know, purposeful I can do it flying he tried in that scene with the TV commercial.
And your point, again, if I'm not mistaken, is it may be that the filmmakers weren't trying to elicit that thought from us, but that came to you. And is it your suggestion to all of us then that we go to regular secular movies, sometimes R-rated movies, which you don't pass judgment on? Thank you for that. But should we look for spiritual value in movies where it wasn't even intended?
If you find that to be a rewarding way to have a movie experience, yes. But again, I'm not arguing this is how we have to look at movies. And it's not necessarily how I look at every movie. Despite writing the book, I'm not going into every film now saying, now,
right.
what type of prayer does this fit into? Because then I think I'm doing what I talked about earlier, where I'm trying to force an idea on a film. what I really tried to do here is research and think about forms of prayer and then say, okay, what movies come to mind now that I know this? So it's certainly a legitimate framework to bring to movies, but I'd be careful about being too restrictive. You've got to let the movie speak first. You know, you've got to let the movie have the first say. Take seriously the decisions the artists have made in creating that movie. And after you've acknowledged that, then I think it's fair to say, okay, and now because of my experience or my lens, here's how those choices get filtered through me. So it's a little bit of a balancing act, but if this is one way of looking at movies that you find rewarding, absolutely, go for it.
I'm not an especially religious person. I thought this book was just so insightful, interesting. It's really a clever read. Movies Are Prayers by Josh Larson. It just beeped 11 o'clock. We'll do the news here. As you go, Richard Roper, another critic in town, said that Baby Driver is the best movie of the century. Did you like Baby Driver a lot?
I'm going to say that's a little high praise for a movie that I enjoyed but had some steep drop-off from the parts I enjoyed to the parts I didn't.
Let's talk movies again another day. It's nice to visit with you, Josh.
Thanks so much, John. I appreciate the time.
11:08. For some reason, Sam Panionovich is featuring the Serbian national baseball team's appearance in Northwest Indiana in his sportscast.
I'm Serbian.
I did not know that.
Everybody thinks Violetta is the only one.
Violetta Podramatic and Sam Panionovich. You know, my last name in real life sounds a lot like your two. My family goes all the way back to maybe not Serbia, maybe Croatia.
You didn't say that word, did you? No, we're fine. We're fine.
So what recommendations are we getting for the Serbian national baseball team? They don't have a name.
The hottest one on the text line is the Serbian Sabres.
Nice! Nice!
That's the most common one. We've got the Serbian Shockers. We've got the Serbian Serpents. We've got the Serbian Stingers. Serbian Salukis.
Like that.
The Serbian Teslas, because they're electric. The Violeta Problematics.
They're Problematics.
Serbian Samaritans.
I like slaw dogs, you know, because a hot dog is what you have there. Slaw sounds like Serbia. And I bet they eat cabbage, the Serbian slaw dogs.
I'm Sadma. Sadma is the dish. It's like pigs in a blanket.
No kidding, really.
So the Serbian Sadma would be another one. Serbian Snaga, which means strength in Serbian.
Nice.
Serbian Slammer, Serbian Spirit, Serbian Saints.
Okay. Well, so those are some of the recommendations that we're getting for the Serbian national baseball team. We'll forward them along. You can continue to text to 312-981-7200. Each week here at WGN Radio, we record a podcast called The Mincing Rascals, usually with Eric Zorn from the Chicago Tribune. He couldn't join us this week. Our friend Mark Baser did. You see him on Channel 11 as well as throughout town on his interview show. Also joining us is Kristen McQuarrie on the editorial board and our own Steve Bertrand. We had a lot of topics of conversation, but we began our conversation this week, and it's where we'll begin our broadcast with a conversation about the fact that Illinois finally got a budget. And in that, Kristen McQuarrie says...
And the Daily Herald has some interesting numbers today if you're wondering how it impacts you. They did household income and how much the tax hike will impact you. Moody's did say recently, one of the rating agencies, that we are still at risk for junk bond status because we've dug ourselves so far into the hole that even with this measure that could bring some stability, they still might ding us.
Is there anyone who thinks this problem can be solved without a tax hike? The governor agrees there needs to be a tax hike, right?
Yeah, he campaigned on it.
So I don't quite understand. I mean, obviously, everyone's opposed to it. No one wants a tax hike. But everyone also agrees that if we want to fix this, this is what needs to be done. Mm-hmm.
There's no fixing it, really. Not in this year. This is going to take a decade.
We want to stop the leaking in the boat. Everyone kind of agrees there has to be a tax increase.
So I wouldn't say everyone does agree with that. But
the governor's deal is, though, that he says, I'll give you the tax hike in exchange for these other things.
And that's been the sticking point all along. That's where you and Eric kind of square off sometimes.
Right. Because that's why you saw most Republicans in the General Assembly vote against this. You might have seen some of them get on board if they had passed any number of the governor's agenda items, but they have not. So in their minds, this is just pouring more money into a broken system.
But, you know, you say there's no fixing it, meaning that we're not going to solve this year, but we're not ever going to solve it without a tax hike. Taxes have to go up in Illinois, right?
I personally believe that. I believe that a 3.75% personal income tax is too low for the size of our state. We have the fifth highest population. I don't think going up to 4.95, which is what this plan is unreasonable. But again, even with all those billions of dollars, we are just kind of paying off debt, paying down debt at a rate that won't even keep up because we're just so far in the hole.
So what's a better solution for you?
I mean, I would like to see, if we're going to see a tax hike, I would like to have seen some pretty dramatic pro-business reforms, and the legislature is unwilling to do that.
What is the connection between some of the things that the governor does want, though, like workers' comp changes? Like, what does that have to do with the budget, or is it just that's the way politics is normally done, wheeling and dealing? But at this state of crisis, it seems to me
you
got to
give
immature.
Up this time. Yeah.
I hear that argument a lot. I would argue the opposite, that we are so much in the hole that we need to go further with some of these reforms that he wants, not fewer. There's no question we are losing businesses, we are losing residents, even Democrats in the city who don't want to see things like workers' comp. You will hear from small business owners throughout the city, whether they're in Chatham or downtown, that workers' comp rates are too high here and they can cut their workers' comp costs in half. They just can't close the gap. But I don't think that's unreasonable that our workers' comp rates mirror those of all of our surrounding states. I don't think it's unreasonable that you give businesses a lower cost to start a business, you know, lower the LLC fees, some of these other things that have been on Governor Rauner's agenda. I do think they are part of the overall economic health of the state, and so they should be tied to the budget.
Really?
In my
so
opinion.
You're for going past the deadline. You're for year three without a budget.
No, absolutely not. No. I also just know the math. It's too late. We can all write higher checks, but unless they do pension reform, unless they maybe take out a loan to pay down the backlog of bills, unless they do other things with this budget package, it's really not going to make much of a difference.
Makes you wonder if you were somebody who provided a service that the state would contract for, if you really want to even bid on that job anymore.
We've been a deadbeat in paying our bills since, 2005 or 6 is when we started getting that backlog started climbing.
Yeah.
We do things in this state that other people would probably be prosecuted for.
Well, sure.
What's the real reason that some members of the Republican House have said we're okay with this budget deal? Is it because of politics for them, or do they actually think that we just need to do it, or are they afraid that they won't be reelected in their area?
Oh, I think they risked their reelection by voting for it, but I also have a lot of empathy for some of them, especially who are downstate. Their communities have already been decimated for 10, 12, 15 years. Many of them come from university towns, and they're watching students not go to Southern Illinois University anymore, not go to Eastern Illinois University, mass layoffs. The universities have been starved probably the most out of this whole budget crisis.
I have a good friend who just quit her job at a state university here. She's a law professor, to move to a new job in Jersey. Like, that's how bad it is. She's like, yeah. Jersey's fine. I'll do a good school in Jersey.
Sorry about that, Jersey.
Well, they're just as,
no,
just as
not.
Corrupt. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah,
I'm not,
and they
I'm
just,
not,
they
it's
just,
not a dig on the state. I love the water.
Illinois keeps its beaches open, right?
Yeah,
there
right. By the way, did you see so Chris Christie's famously now lounging on the beach during the 4th of July holiday? They didn't have enough money. A stretch of beach was closed. There he is with his family. So everybody's been making memes and GIFs out of it. And do you see the one that, quote unquote, won was a Chicago novelist who inserted his book in Chris Christie's hand
perfect.
On the beach?
Oh, nice.
Well, you know, Brad Thor.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think
that's the guy.
I don't think he did he insert it or was he really reading it?
He was not really reading it.
Oh.
He had his guy insert that in there. They said, boy, everything is great in this picture for a day at the beach except a good summer book. Light bulb. They actually digitally inserted that.
That's very funny because I've known – you probably met Brad before,
I have
right?
not,
no,
I,
so
yeah.
forever. And I saw him tweet that out, and I just assumed the Brad Thor books are the sorts of things that Republican lawmakers read.
Oh, my
read,
God,
you know?
Steve, this is how
I really
fake
thought
news
he,
gets
fake
made.
News,
you
fake
know?
News. Shame absolutely. On Thor because he's a real –
Brad.
Right, he's a conservative,
very conservative
right?
conservative guy,
mm-hmm,
yeah.
Yeah.
I thought he was really reading that book.
Yeah,
I thought, well, Brad's got a nice one there.
By the way, just for a moment, since we're on that topic, what's the takeaway from the Chris Christie story? Mark, what did you think, feel, hear? I mean, obviously he quit caring what people think a long time ago.
I just, several people made the comment that photo is as emblematic of this age as any. And I think that's absolutely correct.
Not just Christie, but yeah. the disconnect between politics and the people.
Sure.
Yeah. Is that kind of where you are on that one?
Yeah. I mean, it has to go. If you had to rank the top 10 most tone-deaf moments in politics in the past 50 years, that has to be on the list because he was defiant even after he was caught.
I was going to say.
Well, you want to be on the beach, then you get elected.
You become
governor.
Tone-deaf implies that they didn't, they regret it, you know, or that it was a mistake. I think they must, well, I guess they didn't know they were going to be seen from the air. But, I mean, it was a party. It wasn't, you know, Mary Pat and the governor. There were like 10 people out there.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't one of those sort of, I thought
it
originally.
It was a day at the beach.
Yeah, and I think the way they originally sold it, though, was not knowing there was photos, that he stopped by the beach, you know, like rolled up shirt sleeve. I'm here to maybe a photo op. Look at this empty beach. The people deserve to have the beach open, something like that. No, they had flip-flops on. You know, they came with baskets. They went to the beach.
Well, they were enjoying having the beach to themselves. Yeah. It was awful. It was so awful. And I think he was asked about it at a press conference, something about, oh, looks like you got some sun.
Did you get some sun today? Yeah.
And then he basically lied. And then once he knew there were pictures, then he
confessed. Spokesman cleaned it up. Yeah. Is there anyone else who has fallen so quickly as Chris Christie, I mean, in modern politics?
Maybe he had a metal detector looking for money for post-governorship.
Right.
There's a very interesting
story from somebody in Reason magazine in the Tribune today. I don't know if you all saw this. And it's an op-ed piece. And the guy said that when the president says things that are not true, they may not be considered lies if the president doesn't think that
they're a lie. Okay.
Right. So it's either his sort of, you know, conspiracy theory, or it's his misunderstanding of the facts. But either way, when he says things that aren't true, we are wrong to label them as lies.
Well, we've kind of talked about that,
whether
something is a lie or is not a lie. A lot of people are saying that it's a lie.
So if an insane person thinks something, it can't be a lie. It's just that it's in their mind.
Well,
I'm not saying a person is.
In that instance, I think you make the point. I don't think the president's insane. I think he conveniently looks away from some facts that would refute.
Nobody said he was insane, John.
What are you saying, John? So if I say that Chris Christie was holding a Brad Thor book, if I don't know that it's not true, I'm not lying.
I'm going to skip back to Chicago for just a second. This is a visual, but we'll be making part of our video before the podcast itself. Gary McCarthy is running for mayor. And he has a beige button with blue. He has sort of
it's goldish, I think.
A brownish. Yeah. It's, if that's gold, then he needs to talk to his art team.
Newspaper photo.
It's a sad brown. And then he has GMFM typed across the button.
It sounds like a band you'd see at Pitchfork.
I thought that was like a nasty abbreviation that you text to people. Oh, GMFM.
I'm like, start using it.
Yeah, let's figure out what it really means.
Well, let's all tweet it out all day today.
GMFM. I'm like, well, what does that mean? It's his initials, Gary McCarthy.
For mayor.
For mayor.
Well, it's like he went to Zazzle.com and spent 2 minutes ordering buttons.
Well, he said in the Tribune that he's been approached by people who are really serious about it and that he's not likely to run, but he hates what's happening to the city, so implying he might run.
I think if he did, it would be knowing that he would not win, but just to be that little burr in Rahm Emanuel's side.
You mean like Donald Trump?
Sometimes.
How did Donald Trump get in this conversation?
I don't think Donald Trump thought he was going to win. He thought he was going to be the burr in someone's side.
Yeah, he was going to force an agenda for somebody. You know, maybe that was Bernie Sanders' point, too. Well, at least I'll get the Democrats to put on the platform for Hillary this.
We tend to elect those people now, Kristen.
We do. You're right. I'm going to have to rewrite my whole.
Well, Rahm has, $30 million is a goal for his campaign war chest. I don't know what the point of having $30 million in your reelection war
chest
is.
Keeps people out.
Say it again?
Keeps people out. It will keep people from even challenging you when you have that big. I just find it fascinating that he spent, I mean, to have that type of money, Rahm Emanuel spends a lot of time raising money. And yet he's always pointing the finger at Rauner or all that, you know, do your job. Why aren't you in Springfield? Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you fixing Chicago public schools? And he's saying this from Washington, D.C., where he's talking to the press club. And then he's flying to Canada. And then he's going on vacation. I mean, you know, just maybe you should pipe down a little bit if you're criticizing from afar.
Thank you, Kristen McQuarrie. Thank you, Mark Baser. Steve Bertrand, of course, from WGN Radio. I'm John Williams. That's our Mincing Rascals podcast broadcast. You can hear it in its entirety wherever you subscribe to your finer podcasts. We always post it at WGNRadio.com, and we always post it on my webpage or on my Facebook page. I'm King John on Facebook. By the way, we also have on there our request from you. And it's been one of the busier Facebook posts that I've put up. I'm asking for you to give me the wackiest Trump moments since he first rode down the escalator announcing his candidacy to the present. We got on this kick when he, we all found out that those fake Time magazine covers were displayed at Trump properties. But then after that, it was another thing. And after that, it was another thing. And suddenly go, wow, we've got brackets here. So we're going to make brackets. Wackest Trump moment. And you'll get the feel for it when you check it all out. The pictures, the photos, the videos, etc. On my Facebook page, I'm King John on Facebook. One last note about the Mincing Rascals podcast, and that is, at the beginning, Krista McQuarrie referenced the Daily Herald story that says, if you make this much money, here's what this new tax increase is going to cost you. And the front page of the Chicago Tribune tomorrow has that story with similar sorts of numbers and a little calculator. Put in your income, multiply it by this number, and then here's what you will now pay in addition. I'll give you a couple of examples in a minute.
Jerry, just remember, it's not a lie if you believe it.
Yeah. There it is. There it is. What's the backdrop on that, Griffin? Why are you playing that for us?
Well, it's what you were talking about in The Mincing Rascals, where you're saying if someone doesn't know they're lying, can they be held accountable for that lie? And this is a slightly different situation in Seinfeld, where Jerry's dating a policewoman, and she asks him if he watches Melrose Place. And he says no, but that's not true.
He does.
He does.
Why doesn't he want to admit to watching Melrose Place?
He's embarrassed.
For watching Melrose Place?
It's soap opera, you know.
That's not Hollywood Wives or any of those stupid shows.
This is 20 years ago. I mean, this is 23
that's
years
funny.
Ago.
So Melrose
our
Place
standards
the...
may have changed.
We've fallen so far. Today, that's highbrow.
So she wants him to take a polygraph and answer the question. And that's George's advice right before he leaves.
You've got to believe it. If you believe it's true, then it's not a lie.
It's not a lie if you believe it.
Who knew that that would actually resonate in the presidency years later? By the way, Sam, how are we doing on the name for the Serbian national baseball team?
We're going to go with the Serbian White Eagles. I like that one the best.
Now, hold on. What do you mean we?
I'm going to go with the Serbian White
Okay,
Eagles.
Okay, but can we just pass it around the horn here? Are there any new texts suggesting names? Serbian national baseball team, a delightful group of, amateur baseball players are taking on some semi-pro baseball teams in the area in Northwest Indiana. They're playing in Whiting, are they?
Yeah, playing in Whiting. They're playing against the Northwest Indiana Oilmen. That's a college summer team.
Right.
Then they'll play the Hammond Lakers, and then they'll play the Midwest Collegiate All-Stars.
Okay.
So they're coming in to face some college kids.
Yeah, well, and those summer teams can be pretty good teams, too. I mean, those are college kids. So college baseball players, a lot of them D1 players. I don't know the lineup, but I know how that goes. So these guys are the Serbian baseball program is not developed. So they're probably going to get whacked. But they only lost their first game 8-2.
Only 8-2. Latest submissions, the Serbian Sultans, Serbian Sabretooths, Serbian Shockers.
I got a call that said Serbian Sluggers.
Oh, that makes sense.
The Serbian Sluggers.
We ask for alliteration, King John, and we get it.
I still like Slaw Dogs. Don't you think that at the end of the day, Sabres?
Sabres is just... that's spot
you
on.
Can see some mad Serbian swinging a saber over his head. Maybe they don't love this imagery. And he's got a baseball bat.
You know what sounds good but isn't the best imagery also? The Serbian serpents. Better than the snakes, but it's kind of catchy. I kind of like it.
How about the lamb eaters?
Yeah, I like that.
It's like a lamb rotating on a spit.
You don't like it?
No,
work in progress.
The Serbian lamb eaters?
Lamb is... That's prime meat for Serbians. They love their lamb.
Right. But I mean, so if somebody from Serbia said to somebody from the United States, I've got a great idea for your Chicago baseball team, call it the Chicago Hamburgers.
Hot dogs.
Hot dogs. And then we would say, why? They go, well, because you people eat hot dogs.
It's very foodist. You're right. I apologize.
Well, I'm not mad.
It's foodist.
Okay. So everybody gets a vote. Griff, which of the team would you recommend for the Serbian national baseball team?
Sluggers.
Panionovich goes with?
White Eagles.
Yeah, that's their national bird or symbol.
Animal.
Domati?
I think I got to go with the Sabres.
Yeah. And there I am with Slaw Dogs. So
it's a four-way tie.
We need a tiebreaker.
You got it. It's not the Slaw Dogs. That makes
okay.
no sense.
Okay, it's not the Slaw Dogs.
I thought I would be able to sit here silently and just let it pass, but it keeps coming back, and now I have to speak.
You have to step up.
Absolutely
and
not.
Put down the Slaw Dog. Okay, Sabres. Can we just go with Sabres or no?
It's most popular on the text line. Nah, it's only fair.
Nah.
It's 11:29. News next. I noticed more Whitecaps than usual on the lake driving in today. And yesterday afternoon, as I was driving north on Lakeshore Drive, I saw that the water seemed high. You know, it was right up to the lip of Lakeshore Drive, not the road itself, but the cement sidewalk that they have on the other side. And I saw a lot of people running and jumping into the water where they ask you not to, but it's just so inviting. And when it gets 80, 90 degrees like it is this weekend and tomorrow, then you say, well, count me in. Now they're saying, no, count you out.
Yeah, and the beaches are open. I confirm that. But they are advising you not to jump into that water, at least until 1 o'clock.
Okay, we'll keep you posted on that. Maybe there's other information we'll pass along throughout the afternoon and Sunday as well here on WGN Radio. Every now and then you bump into somebody who does such a good job at the right time at the right place for you that you say, I just want to give a shout out to you and tell other people if they need the same service, a plumber, an electrician, a somebody, then I'm going to give you some props. I've got a lot of garbage coming out of my place because we moved, and I have an amazing, massive amount of boxes and packing paper and things that we moved that we realized we shouldn't have moved and we don't even want anymore. We just got to get it out of here. And so I don't know how I found this guy, but there's a guy in Chicago named Red, R-E-D, and he does hauling. And I didn't know this industry existed, but I just called him up and said, hey, I just got like an unending supply of boxes and paper and things. And the dumpster in my condo is way too small for this. I'm going to be months getting rid of this. He goes, yeah, we'll take it. What do you got? Where are you? Here's what he did. Here's his business model. You take a picture of it, and then you text the picture to him. And he goes, yeah, $75, $50. You go, yeah, really? You'll take all of this stuff and it'll be gone? He goes, yep, we show up and then we take a picture of it and then we take a picture of it gone. And then we text you back those two pictures after you first texted us a picture of it. And then you give us your credit card number. I said, Red, you're my hero. Thank you, sir. One other quick note before we do the Vibe Score segment. If you make $34,000 a year, the Daily Herald noted this week, the new state income tax hike is going to cost you $382 more. $382 more if you make $34,000. If you are a family of three and you earn $75,000 a year, your out-of-pocket goes up $822. If you are a family of four and you're earning $150,000 a year, you will this year pay $1,700 more in taxes. And you know how you get $1,700? You earn about $2,500. Bye-bye. The Chicago Tribune tomorrow has on its front page, impasse over, effects remain. And here's the little calculator. They have some other examples. If your base income is $40,000 and you take some exemptions and your net income is around $37,825, so figure $40,000 your base income. That's line 9 of your state income tax form. You're going to pay $450 more. If you make $100,000, say goodbye to $1,100. If you make $25,000, say goodbye to $262. And on the front page of the paper, they'll have a little calculator. Type in your amount you earned. There's the number to multiply it by. And there is the sad number of how much more you'll pay in income tax in Illinois. It's our Vibe Score segment. We always start out with a song Griffin picks for us. Griff, what are we listening to? I like that a lot.
Fleet Foxes.
I thought that was the Fleet Foxes. We'll come back to that. That's pretty good. I thought that was the Fleet Foxes. Have they been around all along, or did they go away and come back?
They went away. They went away and came back. They put out, you know, their first album was 2008, 2009. They put out another one a couple years after that. Then they were gone for six, seven years, while the lead singer, Robin Pecknold, went to college and just sort of took a break.
Really?
Yeah, the drummer left to become Father John Misty, who we listened to a couple months ago on this segment. He's a solo artist in his own right, doing very well, possibly doing even better than Fleet Foxes. I mean, because they've been gone. But so they just put out a new album. It's the first in a long time. It's called Crack Up. And that was the song Fool's Errand.
All the songs on that album, like the song you just played for us?
Sort of. It's
harmonies.
They were known for being, you know, rich harmonies, acoustic sort of jams, pretty mellow. It was sort of the stereotype version of what their sound is. This one is really knotty. It's like dense. There's a lot of different musical ideas that clash. There's a lot of like 9-minute songs, so it's a little harder to infiltrate as a casual listener. But I think it's worth checking out. People should look into it.
I sure like the previous CD. Is this their second one then?
This is the third one now. They did the self-titled and Helplessness Blues in 2011, and then this one.
I don't know which one that I used to listen to a lot, but I sure did like that.
Yeah.
And I always make a mistake when I try and compare one band or sound to another. But those sort of layered harmonies, I just think are wonderful. I don't know if that's a little Crosby, Stills, and Nash-ish to some people.
I think, yeah, one of the members of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, I wish I could remember which one, has talked some smack about the Fleet Foxes.
Really?
I'll have to look it up and get back to you on that. But yeah, no, I mean, that's an obvious influence, yeah.
Fair enough. All right. By the way, scale of 1 to 100, Griff, Fleet Foxes generally, that little clip you played for us, I'll ask you to come back to it maybe before we get done, but I'm going to give that a 90. I think that sounded awesome.
I'm around there. I'm 87.
Hey, Dom T, you listening? You playing five score? What do you give? 1 to 100?
I give it a 75.
I knew you weren't going to like that. I knew you weren't going to like
75 is a good score.
Oh. Yeah, it's pretty. It's okay. It was okay. Bob in here loves it. He said a great song there. He gives it 100. Yeah.
Hey.
And Bob knows his music, by the way. he plays the harmonica. Are you musically inclined, Domati? Do you play any instruments?
No, I'm a writer. I write poetry. I'm more of a writer, but I can't play an instrument. No, I tried the guitar. It's sitting there collecting dust.
Hold on 1 second, Domati. Griff, what's the play on that? If somebody volunteers that they write poetry, is it incumbent upon the person who's just discovered that to say, oh, really? Do some of your poetry for us?
Well, yeah, not right now, but we'll come back to it. I would love to hear some in the future.
Yeah. Thanks for the bailout, Griff. I appreciate that.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but...
Well, if somebody says, hey, I play the banjo, you go, oh, really? You play the banjo? Oh, play the banjo for us sometime. I didn't know if poetry fell into that same sort of give and take. By the way, were you able to hear, by the way, Sam, our Fleet Foxes?
I didn't hear it. I do like the Foxes, though.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was in transit.
He was getting the Serbia national baseball team souvenir t-shirts for us.
I couldn't get the app on the elevator. I'm sorry.
Wow. Very nice. Syria.
Syria. Uh-oh.
It looks like Syria. It's S-Y.
No, it's not.
No, Serbia. It is. I know it's. I know there's a different country called Serbia and Syria, but, oh, yeah, that's S-R-B. It looks like S-R-B-U-A.
Well, Serbia is spelled S-E-R-B-I-A, but in athletics they spell it S-R-B-I-J-A.
I don't want to tell them they're spelling the name of their country wrong on their t-shirts, but it looks wrong to me. All right, Griff, what else have we got on our Vibe Score segment here?
We'll go to sports. Sam's down here now. Lonzo Ball made his summer league debut last night. I don't know if you saw this.
This is insane.
It doesn't seem to have gone very well.
Who saw that coming? Well, wait, are they going to retire his number now, or are they going to wait until he has the all-star career that he's supposed to
have?
He
went 2 for 15.
He took 11 threes and missed 10.
Nice, nice. Well, you know, it's a step back further in the NBA. So
and the rims are a little bit tighter.
He did not say that, did he?
No, they are.
Are they really?
Oh, yeah. They tighten the rims up when you get to the NBA.
Okay, fine.
So
the hole is the same size, though, right?
Yes.
The basket?
I think the question is, what do you think this first season is going to look like for him?
Okay, are we predicting?
100 is he's going to lead him to a championship.
And 0 is he's going to have to go back to I don't know. The minors. He's going to play for Serbia's national baseball team. I'm going to say, yeah, the guy's talented, but it's such a step up. 70. How about you? What do you give him? What would you? 100 is the best he could.
100 is a championship. And you give him a 70. Give him a 7.
Well, the problem is a lot of us, the poor kid, you know, we don't know much about him, but we don't like his dad. And so everybody's kind of, you know, I think already rooting against him before he's even set foot onto the court. His father isn't helping him at all.
He's not. I give it a 50. I split 50? The difference. I feel sorry for the kid. His dad is bringing him too much attention and distraction.
Where are you on this, Griff?
I'd go 52. Who knows?
Quite the range.
What else you got for us, Griff?
It's telling that the sports guy went with 7, though. I think that's...
Find your lead, and I guess that's where we should be.
You mentioned the movie Baby Driver to Josh Larson when you were talking to him earlier in the show, and we posted that.
I'm intrigued by this because I haven't seen this movie yet. I don't like it much, though. It's just way too musical and way too much car chasey. It's a genre I've seen before, and I'm not a big fan.
But you have not seen it.
I'm going to give it a 15.
People are not used to hearing you speak. Other people speak with such confidence on something they don't really know about. So it's just incumbent on me to be absolutely clear. You haven't seen it.
I have not seen the movie.
Yeah. I do think it's being overrated, though. I saw it. I enjoyed it very much.
Roper told Rokan best movie of the century.
Well, I'm sure he was being a little facetious.
I'm not sure.
I think probably. It was just how much fun he had. And it is really fun. And by the end, I was a little...
Well, is it a little Mad Max like that, where you go, I don't know if this is a great movie, but wow, was that a great ride?
Yeah, but Mad Max was really a great movie.
Yeah.
This one is super fun. You should go watch it. I'd give it like an 82.
What's the title again?
Baby Driver.
Baby Driver.
You haven't heard about it?
Haven't heard about it.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Can I vote? I don't think I can vote then.
You do read newspapers, don't you?
I do.
You've been around? It's quite the rage.
When all is said and done, it'll be like La La Land was last year, where people come out of it, they had so much fun in the theater that they tell everybody it's the best movie ever, and then a week later they can't really remember everything. it's not sticking with you as much. That's how I feel about it.
Yeah,
so,
fair enough.
And that's not on the movie. Like, that's just people overselling it, but it's still a good.
Or sometimes
good
that's all a movie sets out to be. It's not life changing. It was just, wow, was that a fun thing?
Exactly.
And then you forget about it on the way out.
Exactly, and I think that's fine.
Do you guys see Melania's flapper dress that she wore at the G20 summit?
I missed that one.
White dress with the sort of fringy bottom, kind of layered as it goes down. On a scale of 1 to 100, I'm giving Melania's flapper dress an 84. I'm a fan.
You seem to generally be a fan of Melania's fashion. So
well,
I think...
because I think she just hits it out of the park every single time. So there's that. And I also think, by comparison, she seems to be the most sane of the Trumps. Don't need to go there, but, you know, she, I don't think, makes many mistakes. Her biggest mistakes are by omission. There are times where you wish she'd come out and put her husband in his place. For the rest of us, that's never going to happen. Other than that, I think she seems to know her place. She's not stepping into his light too much, and she wears clothes terrific.
I like the term flapper. Based on flapper alone, I'll raise your 84 to an 87.
Well, there you are. Man voting without even having seen the dress gives it an 87.
Couple of fashion experts here.
I just Googled the dress. This is fashion forward.
Yeah.
I give it a 90. I'm an expert in all things fashion, Griff.
There's probably not a collection of people less qualified to talk about fashion than the three voices you've just heard here on WGN Radio. Do we have any more information? I was thinking it would be great to jump into Lake Michigan today on purpose. Do we know anything more, Domati, about the beaches being closed?
We do. Your resource is cpdbeaches.com. So apparently there are some beaches where there are no restrictions, right? So if you go to this website, cpdbeaches.com, there's a green check mark if there are no restrictions, and then there's a yellow exclamation point if there's a swim advisory. So you're able to go to those beaches, but you're advised not to jump into the water. And some of those beaches, Rainbow Beach, Montrose Beach, North Avenue Beach, but then there are others where it's safe. So head over to that website if you guys plan on getting out there today.
The Chicago Park District's site is cpdbeaches.com.